Hello. It's good to talk to you. I think we have two primary subjects of interest for ourselves at the moment, but let us try to sum over the meaning of where we've been in order to try to bring our attention to bear most usefully on where we are in the process right now. There are two primary subjects for us in our term together as a whole, one of which is how to be creative in law school, how to have a relationship to law school's intellectual activity, and if it ever resumes social activity again, to the social activity of being in law school, the purpose of which is to make learning more effective and more joyful for you so that you can use your ability to make ideas to do what you consider to be well. The second overall subject of our time together is how to be creative in thinking about being a lawyer in society yourself. That is to say, to understand how the learning that you do and the creating of ideas that you do here can help you to have a different and more self-empowered view of how a lawyer's life, which includes her career, is made. The beginning of that inquiry, or rather those two inquiries braided together, was a brief philosophical prelude in realism for the purpose of explaining two things. First of all, where lawyers' ideas in law school have been coming from for the last 125 years or so, what the legal sensibility and tradition is in which you are now becoming a part, having spent the first term in law school mastering law talk, and second, how the thinking about legal matters in a realistic way, things are what they do, not what they're called, and the ways that we narrate what we do when we are judges, but perhaps not only when we are judges, but when we are A, human beings, and B, lawyers. The ways we narrate the choices that we make are rationalizations, both in the larger and more important public sense, that they create a relationship between what we think the rules are. If this happens, then that happens. And what we think the conditions around us in society are. In view of the fact that X, Y, and Z are going on, then we have to do X, Y, Z, T things because we have rules. If A, B, C, then D, E, F, and we need to apply them to the current situation as we have it. So, in that structure of how legal thinking goes on and how social activity goes on, because from Holmes forward, people are recognizing that the question is how to make things happen in society using words, which come in two basic forms. How to get for the client out there in the world some social consequences that the client desires, making the things the client wants happen in society using words, and the form in which the purpose of using the words is to help the client understand what she wants so that she can make decisions, where therefore what is happening in society is The client is better counseled and advised. These are two fundamentally different forms of activity in lawyering. They are both making things happen in society using words. And the direction of the words can be thought of as outward of the relationship between the lawyer and the client, or in the relationship between the lawyer and the client. And there is a universe of creativity in both, from which the creative lawyer benefits in every way, in the proportion of every way that she wants to benefit. That's the general overall purpose of the prologue, which we went through together. And now we are in the middle of the long second part of this. I suppose you could call it the slow movement, in which we are attempting to evolve from the original realist point of view through consilient explanations drawing upon multiple social sciences and humanities without distinction between those two potentially equivalent words. We are attempting to draw a thing you would get if you had a bunch of insight into humanity and a bunch of insight into society, to the extent that those two things can be differentiated, which would be called a lawyer's theory of human society or social action, because we are, after all, trying to make things happen in society using words. And so we're trying to figure out what kinds of lawyering there are, in part by thinking about what kinds of roles lawyers play in social process. That's the outward-looking part. And in part by trying to understand how lawyers and clients together figure out what it is that they want, which is the inward-looking part. In all those forms of interrogation which are involved in either the outward-looking or the inward-looking part, we're trying to figure out how various views of the world, from Darwinian views of biology and intrapsychic psychology to all the various forms of intrapsychic psychology that follow from the ideas that we call Darwin and Freud, to all the social psychologies that might explain how minds influence minds, which is, of course, the fundamental question in the initiation of making things happen in society using words, because words are addressed to minds. And then there are all the ways in which the structures of society, their institutions and the mental practices that fit within the broadest definition of institutions, and the forms of self-understanding which allow a self to exist in order to seek to make something happen in the world as a form of agency, or maybe just as a form of acting in role, all of which occurs within the structures of mental systems we call culture, which explain to human beings and allow other human beings to interpret the explanations thus given what it means at any given moment to be a human being doing whatever it is at any given moment seems to be a thing. Which brings us to the history of things done and the reasons for doing them, and the philosophic contexts in which, within the confines of particular culture, cultural thinking gets thought about, because culture isn't only custom or practice or things getting done, it's also in society using words, at least as far as lawyers are concerned, which means they're going to have as vexed a relationship to the philosophers as they will have to the anthropologists. And so we are trying to understand how not a view of social action, but a particular lawyer's view of social action, that is to say, the bringing to bear of as many different kinds and knowledges as the lawyer can bring herself to be interested in, applied to the places where the lawyer is trying to make things happen in society using words, and he has to have some particular way in which, within the form of the world he lives in, where the ifs and the thens are such as they are, and the ases and the wherefores and the therefores are such as they are, how he brings to bear everything he knows in the process of making things happen either faster or better or cheaper or just more in actual fruition of the client's best advised and most thoroughly counseled decisions about what the client wants. And in that process, which is now turning its corner in a way, we meet precisely as we ought to in such a place at such a time, a judge. I don't mean we meet a judge in the sense that you meet a ton of judges in law school. It's just a train station full of judges all the time. And I don't mean meet a judge in the way that you might if you took up reading judicial biography. In my experience, the most dedicated readers of judicial biography as a genre can be divided into two classes: the judicial biographers, who of course read judicial biographies all the time and think about how they should be made, and even those of us who have never written a judicial biography but who have been trained as legal historians and who have hung out with a bunch of judicial biographers, when we pick up a judicial biography, it's likely to have that feeling to us. Looking at a good craftsman's machine and figuring out exactly how she used all of her skills and energies in order to put it together. But the other really important class of judicial biographers, that is, the people for whom in the end it turns out that judicial biographies are written by judicial biographers who are so interested in doing it well, the actual readers are the judges. I've never known a more dedicated genre collection of readers of historical scholarship than the judges, because they read judicial biographies all the time. They have, of course, a different reason for doing that. They just want to understand how to do the job. Now, this is the interesting part, because judicial biographies are written in the common law world. And they're not mostly written in the world where the way that you become a judge is you go to school to be a judge and you get out and you're a very junior judge, and over time the state bureaucracy promotes you to higher and higher levels of judging. In the civil law world, there is by and large not much need for judicial biographies, because there is not much... Well, I mean, you could think that the reason is that there is not much relationship between the individual complex humanity and the judging. Right, judicial biography isn't necessary because the biographies of judges are somehow not very relevant. But that's not actually anybody's point of view, because everybody knows that judges are human beings. In the civil law world, there are occasions when the prosopography, that is, the group, collective biography of judges, becomes important. Distinguished careers have been built on the prosopographical investigation of the judges of the Third Reich, for example. How did an entire coterie of the bureaucrats of the post-imperial interwar German Democratic Republic in the lowercase, not communist party-led sense come to become the functionaries of the judicial machinery of the fascist Third Reich? A Reich, to be sure. And therefore related to order and to Recht, and in some fashion which has to be explained. Not only by the dissection of the behavior of the fascists, moreover, and not only by reference to some articulated political theory of fascism, whether that turns out to be a culturalist explanation a la George Mossy or an institutionalist economic explanation as a la Henry Turner, or it's more complicated than that in every sense. And personally, though I am interested in it as a lawyer, an American, and a Jew, I am more interested in Robert Cover's attempt to understand the behavior of anti-slavery judges rendering pro-slavery decisions in antebellum America in Justice Accused, partly because, after all, I learned from Cover, and I am, as a historian, inevitably shaped by the work of my teachers. That's how history works, as well as historiography, after all. But from the point of view of the lawyer trying to make things happen in society using words, I don't doubt that in the end, the social psychology, the influence of minds directly operating on minds, would be more useful in understanding even someone who has read judicial biographies to figure out how to make them instead of judges reading judicial biographies. As far as I can recall, the only judge I ever knew closely who didn't read judicial biographies was Thurgood Marshall. And I'm totally not surprised. He read all kinds of things. But, see, in our system, where people become judges after having had full and complex careers doing other things, whether the judge is Celia Day or the judge is Thurgood Marshall, the Bildung, what made the person, and also, therefore, what made the judge, is to be found in an infinite variety of experience outside the context of judging. Another way to think about this would be to say that the personality states of judges, which develop over time, and which, of course, are shaped by the judicial role, because judges are judges all the time. Even when they go home, they're still judges. The personality states of judges in our legal order are built upon a variety of experience and then the development of the judicial personality state. For judges in civil structures where judging is a career path unto itself, and from juniority through promotion to retirement, civil service is the structure of judicial life, the judicial personality develops differently. If the real readers of judicial biography are, in fact, the judges, then the reason that in our world they read about other judges all the time is they're all learning how to be judges late in life. And that's not a disadvantage, but it is a differentiation of a very important kind, because the judges are both shape to the work, acting by the force of their commissions, as Celia Day says, and also people of deeply complex, differentiated life experience which has formed them in fundamentally different ways. The common thread in the resume is often, maybe almost always, prosecutor. Those who become federal district judges and who are promoted to or join the courts of appeals system in the federal bench are rarely people who have not been prosecutors at least one stage in their careers. Elsewhere in the world of judging in the United States, where judges are elected and where political party nomination structures are important in determining who gets to the ballot, as in New York State, or who will be voted for, even where ballot access is more open than in most of the rest of the United States. The process of running for office as a judge will make the common thread of experience connection to the political process through the electoral machine. If you elect your judges, they will get elected and they will run in elections and they will have relationships to the way elections are conducted, even if those are only judicial elections, wherever they are. So the common thread in the federal judiciary may be service in the prosecutorial services, as the common thread in state-elected judges is relationship to the electoral process, but once again, it is in no way standard. Judge Day, though she has been a prosecutor and even a chief assistant in what is apparently the Southern District of New York, though I think it might possibly have been not the Southern District of New York, Judge Day, though she has been a prosecutor, does not think primarily like a prosecutor. She thinks like a government lawyer, including in that nonpartisan civil service sense, which is deep in her. Potter Stewart, once talking to James Reston, known universally as Scotty, the columnist of the New York Times at some Greenwich, Connecticut cocktail party, remembered that there is always a place where the press and power mingle. Potter Stewart, in a conversation of a kind over drinks with Scotty Reston, once famously said, "I'd never vote in elections." And Scotty Reston said, "Gee, that's odd. Why not? I do." But Judge Day knows why Potter Stewart does not. And while I think she does vote, she recognizes, I believe, that in doing so, she votes in a nonpartisan manner. That used to be possible in the New York State in which Judge Day grew up and in the Washington, D.C. in which she served. The current state of affairs has largely been arranged at the expense, as Judge Day herself is theorizing in her conversation with the poet, by the elimination of the nonpartisan parts of both parties. The New York that had in it the nonpartisan parts of both the Democratic and Republican parties. I'm not now talking about moderates. I'm not talking about the people who were the moderate Democrats or the moderate Republicans. The nonpartisan Democrats and Republicans were people affiliated with the political structures of the parties who were regarded by all sides as the honest brokers, the diplomats and the judges, and in here, this is really important, the federal prosecutors, not everywhere, not all the time, in fact, in alternation often with partisans, but whom everybody understood were of the kind in which political affiliation was secondary to another form of restraint on the use of power. You could think of it as by principle, but that's probably the less important element of the thing, because principle varies from person to person regardless of the other elements of the sort of folk categorization of character. And it varies because, well, we must always remember the multiplicity of personality. So here we are meeting a judge, not in the sense of judicial biography. A judge doesn't need to read the poem to know how to be a judge. And yet, if we are to think about how to be various kinds of lawyers, including possibly the kind who want to be judges, there are lawyers who want to become judges all their careers. My primary school contemporary at the Hunter College Elementary School, Justice Elena Kagan, is a good example. Elena always wanted to be a judge. Sometimes she had no difficulty admitting that, and sometimes for reasons that were connected with her deep capability and enormously effective life lived becoming a judge, she was more reluctant to talk about it, but she always wanted to be a judge. I know a number of other lawyers, deans, presidents of universities and such things, who also always wanted to be judges, but they weren't as good at it. But it didn't matter, because in the end they were, at least I hope they were, happy doing something else. There's not just one right way for every lawyer to be a lawyer. And one can imagine Judge Day fundamentally satisfied in many respects in her life with a different kind of lawyering. Though one question you might want to ask, by which I mean we might want to talk about, is whether Judge Day could be said to be a lawyer who has come to the best possible place for her. There are judges who, after being appointed to lifetime seats in the federal judiciary, discover that they would prefer to be doing something else. And there are also judges who resign either briefly or not very long after becoming judges. That the Venn diagram of those two sets is not completely overlapping. Sometimes, as with Arthur Goldberg of the United States Supreme Court, whom Lyndon Johnson persuaded to abandon a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court for a short duration trip to be UN ambassador for Lyndon Johnson in New York, a decision which I think the other members of the Supreme Court felt like much of the American public that Arthur Goldberg had been rooked into by the wily fox Lyndon Johnson. The justices, in my experience, who served with Goldberg, liked and really trusted and believed in him. And any time that former Justice Goldberg came to the court, an event I witnessed a couple of times, the ability to gather all the justices, or at least all the justices who had served with or knew him, in the justices' dining room was really easy. They just liked being with him, which is a wonderful way to be a justice of the Supreme Court and suggest that maybe he had the job which, of all the jobs as a lawyer he could have had, he should have kept. But the possibility that Judge Day is ideally suited to the work is part, I think, of what this piece of the poem is about, and so we should talk about it when we're together on Monday. It's also important, I think, to see the forms of thinking about judging that characterize Celia Day. They're not the only forms there are. The voice of this judge is an individuated one. But if, as it might be the case, this is a particularly good example of how it feels to be a judge, I don't mean an example of how it feels to be a good judge. There are many ways for it to feel to be a good judge, and even for some agreed-upon definition of what is a good judge. But for her, in particular, this judge, the qualities which render her suited wholly or partially to the work she does are ones which she can voice very clearly for us, because the poet can very clearly imagine her, and in that process there is much to learn. I would also call attention to the part of this poem which reflects the way in which sentiments now regarded as having been magically created in 2016 by and through the election of Donald Trump, and sentiments equally thought somehow by a large part of the United States to have been created at the moment when George Floyd found himself dying from lack of breath because a policeman had his knee on his neck, were present and deeply present in the United States of a quarter century ago. The great problems that come from the streets in the mind of Judge Day are the problems of now. And while it is true that Judge Day is a well-established professional class, serious member of the third branch of the United States government, and is a woman and a white person in the United States of 1997, and therefore she is not a Black Lives Matter leadership cadre of now, by any damn means, it is perfectly obvious that she is as capable of identifying what is the problem in the United States as we are now, and it didn't start yesterday, and it isn't about the particular boiling over of any rage on any particular side. It isn't Trump and the Proud Boys, and it isn't Antifa and BLM in the views of the opposing armies in this state of civil wars. Not because it isn't them, but because it's always the result of what has been, for pretty much all your lifetimes and a large part of mine, the consequence of everything that was left over by the history that entered into our respective lifetimes. Even though mine is more than twice as long as most of yours. And what we at any given moment are doing, if we are Judge Day, is discerning what that's all about. And if we haven't ceased active practice of law, oh, you know, that's really what happens when you become a judge. If you're a New York lawyer, then you tell the Bar Association, the Bar Council, every 2 years when the time comes to renew your law license that you are not actively practicing law, and so you don't pay dues. If you leave the bench, you go back to actively practicing law again. Your law license doesn't have to be reapplied for. You still have it. But judging and the active practice of law, that is, lawyering, are different, and it's true. Because even though all the time that we're in law school, we're reading opinions by judges who are allegedly making things happen in society using words, they're not even actively engaged in the practice of law while doing so. The people actually lawyering, trying to make things happen in society using words, aren't judges. This is a little bit less than appears to meet the eye, because the bureaucrats in state government who aren't judges are continuing to maintain their law licenses by paying dues and saying that they're actively engaged in the practice of law. So the apparent poetic distinction, the exacting justice of the thing, is a little bit less than it looks. But Judge Day is, in fact, very clear in her way about her relationship to the law. And it isn't truly that of the lawyer. Or at least, perhaps it isn't. It's a question we might want to talk about. In a poem about a judge, there could be a moment of quasi-erotic lyric. But not surprisingly, it won't be about the judge. It will be about her discernment of it. So we might want to talk a little more about Daisy May and the Lothario from Kent and Swartwout. Larry's good at making up the names of law firms, and they contain multitudes, as his idol Walt Whitman would have said. We should, I think, consider many different parts of the relationship between Judge Day and Daisy May and the Lothario of Kent and Swartwout. But maybe only if we want to understand discerning in its role, not just in law, for the sensibility of an American late 20th and early 21st century federal district court judge. After all, we are located within the system of culture and time, not just the system of culture and time that is being a federal judge, but the system of culture and time which is writing a poem about a federal judge in prose. It is, however, important to ask the question that, like a lawyer, Judge Day asks, which is, if the people who tried to knock over the World Trade Center towers and didn't get it right in 1996 would get it right, as of course they would, if that's what they really wanted to do, and it's probably possible now that we are 20 years further along to ask in some not unreasonable way what actually happened and what were they trying to do. That is, history might be relevant to that, but surely also relevant is Judge Day's lawyer's question. What did happen to all those legal rights and conflicts and all the litigation that she imagines while speeding along on a overdriven subway train down the 456 along Lexington Avenue somewhere south of Grand Central? It's a little twisty there. But was it twisty when the thing actually came to be, and how so and in what ways, you might want to think. I am, after all, basically leaving only the questions behind. But there are many. When I was interviewing for clerkships, when I talked to federal district judges, who weren't all the judges I was applying to, but ultimately the judges I was interested in working for. When I talked to federal district judges and I asked them, as I asked every judge I interviewed with, what did they like least about their jobs, with one exception, almost a full jury box, 11 federal judges all answered the question in the same way. They all said sentencing. This was before the guidelines, in a world in which there was still what Judge Day refers to as a little bit of discretion, and denies, at least in one of her personality states, that that discretion constitutes power. There was still a fairly broad discretion involving immense unwelcome power for every sentencing judge in the federal system, which for most practical purposes can be described as the district judges. There's something important to say about the one judge who didn't say that he disliked sentencing more than anything else, but that's a story for another time. Judge Day's interaction with the poet over her sentencing the next day is a profoundly important little piece of a poem about a judge, about the nature of responsibility as lawyers, and is one of the great lessons of the didactic value of this poem in this section. The other one of which is the question of truthfulness, about which Judge Day's interaction with the poet is as good an introduction to 100 volumes of legal ethics and the problems of representation and honesty as there is. And about that, it is not merely a matter of we should talk about it, it is a matter of you have before you an opportunity to learn lessons that last a lifetime. You should take it. But then, in this I'm speaking altogether in advance of the conversation we have yet to have, and which I will hope that we will have much reason to come back to as we go along. There is nobody more important in our conduct of our lives together than Judge Day. The presence in courses of other law students called teaching assistants is indeed of great value. I'm not sure that the teaching assistant's value is to the student, but you are the student and you make up your own mind. Judge Day is not a teaching assistant. Judge Day is a teacher, though that's not what she thinks she's doing. And that may not even be what the poet thinks she's doing, but she is doing that. And it will be good to figure out what she has to say. So I will act, if I may, as Judge Day's teaching assistant, but we have to get there. We can't just do it now while I look out over the Sunday morning of Manhattan in an isolation booth. Thank you. Which means that there is a little bit of extra time that we could take to think about, well, the other part. If in the effort to become creative in law school, we might actually take up Felix Cohen's view and try and understand the judges, but perhaps not for the purpose of predicting in the way that he and Holmes are discussing, but perhaps under the assumption that to be in front of a judge is to be engaged in a relationship with that judge, and to understand the judge in the relationship is not merely to understand judging or predict the judgment or to complain about the judicial bias, but actually to understand in a relational sense the judge. And if that's what we're doing, then maybe we could also be learning something about how to be lawyers ourselves. Because I was in law school for a very long time, I was the director of one of the board of directors of the Yale Moot Court for a very long time. Indeed, when I worked at Cravath in the in-between period from law school to my clerkships, one of the parts of my deal as a contract hourly spot market lawyer in the Cravath litigation department was that they had to pay to transport me back and forth from California to New Haven, not for law school, although I was still engaged in law school, at least according to me, though the Yale Law School had graduated me prematurely, in my opinion, and I was enrolled in Tony Cronman's bankruptcy course, in which I knew I wasn't going to do well, but I didn't want to. Tony never graded me well, and I took his courses in order to write exams that I knew he wasn't going to like. But the only thing that the firm had to pay for, as far as I was concerned, by way of moving me back and forth, was not to miss the moot court board meetings. And in all the years I spent watching moot court arguments, one of the things that I learned was that if I wanted to predict whom the judges were going to regard as the best oralist, the way to do that was to sit in the back of the courtroom, right as much as I could behind the lectern, and to look at the set of the shoulders and the blades of the back muscles in the suit jacket of each counselor arguing. The best oralist, I discovered, could be predicted by looking at whose posture reflected ease behind the lectern. The suit jacket that was not wrinkled at the back, either horizontally or vertically, not hanging baggy, you understand, like that of some long-serving assistant deputy solicitor generals I have known, but of course, a young person in what was at least intended to be a good suit. It's the ability to stand there with a posture which says, I belong here, and I'm not feeling that I don't belong here, and my state is conjoined with your states up there on the bench, and we are talking about this case, and I am winning. That was what did it, because, of course, moot court judges aren't judging cases, they're judging lawyers. And in the end, that was the quality that most mattered, and it came by nonverbal communication, and I could see it. Predicting what the judges will be like, in fact, is what I mean by lawyering. Predicting what the law students will be like, in fact, when they get out of law school is what I mean by law teaching. And the point isn't to predict and be right. Oh, yeah, I knew they were going to be never any good. Or, yeah, I always knew he was going to be president of the United States or justice of the United States Supreme Court, the Guido Calabresi method. What I mean is that teaching is about trying to help students have visions of a future that they want. And in this, it doesn't matter whether you're teaching first grade or law school. Because human beings are meant to learn. And they can be deprived of the ability to learn by depriving them of pleasure in learning. Which is part of how ignorance is fastened on the poor in the world. And one of the most important determinants of pleasure in learning is that it occurs in the presence of visions of a future that the student wants, but which is absent enough from the student's present life that it can only be reached through the imagination and not through effective but less helpful material appetites. There is, of course, a lot of anxiety in your writing. My way of reading and editing your work in this course is to read everything before editing anything. So I've now completed reading all the writing, and shortly I will begin distributing edited drafts back into the wiki. But reading everything first allows editing to be about two things. First of all, the things that are crucial in improving a particular piece of writing by a particular person. And second, understanding what all our writing means. Your drafts, my comments, your redrafts, if we think about it in terms of the whole of us reading and writing together. It may be that I'm the only person who will proceed in that fashion, or perhaps not. Of course, if you understood that you had time to read everybody's writing, then you would know that you have time. And one of the things that you don't, or we don't, or collectively it would be said that there isn't enough of, is awareness that there is enough of time. Too many people experiencing too little time. It may be that you think that this is the epidemic just, or the way law school is just, or the way it just unjustly is at the moment because it is the combination of law school and the pandemic. But in every case, just is the problematic word. It isn't all those things only, or any of them individually only. It is also that you are being accustomed, educated, acculturated, taught, however you want to call, to phrase it, you are being taught to live in a condition of being behind and not having enough time and thinking that that's what being a lawyer is. Good for you. On one hand, you could say, well, this is because this is the most like being a lawyer that you can be right now since you don't have a license. After all, there are a lot of people whose life as lawyers is like that, and they are the people who consume canned meat at the other end of our canned meat conveyor belt, so it couldn't do any harm to begin right now, as early in law school as possible, like the beginning of law school. It wouldn't do any harm to get you accustomed to lying curled up in a can. That's the condition. There's no time, because indeed, that's one form of law practice. Well, actually, it's many different forms of law practice, but they're the forms of law practice in which the lawyer doesn't control her time. Which is not the only form of law practice, or only forms, or just the way law practice is. There is a lot of anxiety about how to understand how law practice is, And as is typical in law school, both in the epidemic and not in the epidemic, the way that anxiety is being channeled is mostly towards what job are you going to get? Which is, from the point of view of some people, well, just the way it is, and from other points of view, well, kind of odd. But there is a lot of trying to understand what decisions should I be making now, which appear to have a lot to do with bidding on law firms or whatever. But let us actually try to apply some of what we know, or could know, if we cared to know it, about what the choices are that we have and in what order, therefore, we should consider those choices to be made. In the world of practicing law, both outward, that is, making things happen in society using words in society, and practicing law inward, that is to say, making things happen in society using words by changing clients' ways of thinking and therefore decisions about what they want, which is making things happen in society using words in clients. There are, of course, two possible attitudes about what lawyering is. The first attitude will be lawyering is both things, using words outward and using words inward, counseling clients and making things happen out there for them in the world, and that there's some relationship between the two. The second will be to deny that inward-facing words have anything to do with getting or having relationships with clients. There are still inward-facing words, the endless numbers of memos, which eventually, in one way or another, get promulgated to people who make decisions by memos being transmitted to general counsel's offices, then being transmitted onward from the general counsel inside the organization to the business people who are the clients of the general counsel's workers, or whatever it may be, including some face-to-face lunch you're not at between a partner and a CEO. When it comes to how clients come to be in a practice like that, that's not your problem. A decade from now, maybe you will become a partner and you will start to understand how the clients are gotten. Or maybe if you are particularly favored, which is to say painfully and poisonously overworked associate in relatively senior life to a partner who really wants to bring you in, you will start having that awareness earlier and may even be in one way or another secondarily active in it by the time you've been around a half a decade or so. There are forms of law practice which are constituted by the employment relation, and forms of law practice which are organized with equity partners or sole proprietors or LLCs of a small number of people with some shared sense of resource and risk. But the real distinction isn't the form in that sense. It's the relative value placed in the relationship for you, the primary party, I, me, us, the value placed for you between money and your control of time. In some forms of law practice, that relationship is tilted entirely in the direction of money years on end. You get relatively well paid according to the people who tell you how much you should get paid, which is really ultimately the mouthpieces of the people who pay you. You get well paid according to them, and you have no control whatever over your time. None, zero, absolutely none. And anything which renders more control of your time available comes at the expense of, well, at least according to the mouthpieces of the people who employ you, shocking reductions in the net present value of your long-term career in the place, first as an associate and then as a partner. You'll get pie in the sky when you die, too. At least that's the point of view which would be taken by the lawyers whose sensibility runs the other way. Not only do I think that there's a trade-off between money and control of my time that I should actually have some power to change from day to day or month to month or year to year or decade to decade in my practice, but I actually also think that the ability to control my time doesn't in the end have to come at the expense of money if, one, I am a solid planner of my practice and a good engineer of how to use my license and my network, and, well, if I know how much money is enough. There is a slightly greater than even likelihood that you are of the second type of sensibility about these questions because you decided to take this course. And there is an equally small, but I hope non-zero possibility that in the course of taking this course, you might find the personality state in yourself which has that sensibility and which therefore should join the internal conversation in you about what we ought to be thinking about now. Maybe. That is, maybe it would do that, and maybe it can be evoked, and maybe this course can evoke it, and maybe even though the epidemic, I can still do it, even though I'm sitting in an isolation booth looking out over Manhattan on a Sunday morning. But really, that sequence isn't what matters. What matters is, could a vision of how you want to be happy as a lawyer function to make your learning more creative? Because we will know for sure that if you have a vision of how to be happy doing lawyering in America in your forthcoming lifetime, if that, then you will enjoy law school more, and it will work more creatively for you. And as the great revolutionary John Lennon says, it's going to be all right. Talk to you soon.